Since I haven't used half my time already, I better get started. So you want to turn the lights down? Thanks. This afternoon I want to talk to you about some of the work we've been doing on nutritional management during gestation, and not only how it impacts the animal that we think we're impacting, but how does it impact those animals that aren't even born yet. Been doing a lot of traveling lately and literally followed that line. I'm glad to be somewhere I didn't have to get in an airplane. Was in all the way from Coeur d'Alene to Knoxville, Tennessee, and it's amazing. I almost need an interpreter to speak down there. But we're truly, and you heard a lot this morning, it's an interesting area where beef is produced and the consumer we're trying to feed. Over 75% of the population in the United States lives within 100 miles of an ocean. And that's very apparent once you get out to the East Coast, how many people are out there. Got to see some beautiful areas. This was Coeur d'Alene in the fall. Got to go about two or three weeks ago to another place. This make you feel better than with the snow outside, but ZenPro sponsored me on a program. Got to go speak at the Hawaii Cattlemen's Convention and to a group of producers on Maui as well, but got to go to three of the islands. They're in a terrible drought over there. Parker Ranch is the biggest ranch over on the Big Island. 26,000 head of cattle. They've got about 9,000 head of cattle today. But you don't think of Hawaii going experiencing drought like we all do, but they do as well. Drought and deer. Somebody asked me, what were the big issues of the cattle producers in Hawaii? I said, drought and deer. Nebraska, only in Nebraska can you have in the middle of October a tornado on one side of the state and a severe blizzard in the northwest corner, and still haven't got used to this. And not sure what this Big Ten thing is, but apparently isn't all good. So looking forward to a bowl game anyway. So I'm located at West Central Research and Extension Center, which is where the confluence of the North and South Platte Rivers are. This map shows where we have beef cattle research being conducted in Nebraska, and I think it speaks volumes for the importance that the beef industry is to the University of Nebraska and vice versa. And I listened to the game this painful Friday driving up to South Dakota, and J.B. Milliken at halftime said, the University of Nebraska is there for the people of Nebraska. And that largely is why I'm still even there after 10-plus years. He's an attorney, but he still thinks the land-grant mission is important to the university. The Goodmanson Ranch, there are several people here that have done all this work, the day-to-day work. I'd like to thank them before I forget. And people from North Platte, a couple of graduate students. I think Nebraska is pretty well represented. But it's a 13,000-acre ranch, not far into Nebraska. We have about 700 cows, and that's kind of the research I'm going to talk about today. When there's not a drought, there's not a more beautiful place. So mixture of sableye sand dunes and meadows. And some of this work that I'm going to talk about you today has been, as Ivan said, I've got to speak about it and other topics around the country and around the world, actually. We wrote a book chapter on fetal programming for a Brazilian book. And actually, our director was just down there a week ago. And I got to go down there a few years ago, down to that region. Here's the topography was kind of more mountainous, not the big cattle open ranges, but where the university was. They had a symposium that had about 800 people at it, a lot of young people. SIM means symposium, court means cattle. And there were five American speakers, two of them were from Nebraska. And we didn't even know we were going to be there together till about a month before. But interesting, some of the talks this morning talked about world beef production and where beef and cattle are populated. India, number one, Brazil, China, U.S. We're still the number one producer of beef, but there's a lot of cattle in other countries. And we talk about feeding 9 billion people or whatever in 50 years, and I always say, why don't we go after the low-hanging fruit? But those cattle are largely not very productive. But an industry that is growing is Brazil. And their native cattle is in the lore. They call them ghost cattle. And now, here's Ivan said I was interested in heifer development, And not so much working with these nice little creatures, but they did let us get a picture and got out of their pasture. But over half their cattle now spend some time on feed. And we compete on a world and global market with this beef from Brazil. We actually import beef from Brazil. I don't know if everyone is aware of that, but most of their packing plants, nearly all of them, have canneries, which gets around the foot and mouth deal. So they're a big player. And we have a lot of Brazilian students. I've got a student coming this summer that's from Brazil that's going to do a PhD. They're not without their challenges. Ethanol is expensive. They've had to find cheaper ways to get around, just as we've had to in the United States. I've done a lot of talks in Kansas, and I tell people in Kansas, this is your neighbor. This is not my neighbor. So I hadn't been to Oklahoma a few weeks ago. I was in Oklahoma. I said, this is you all. So I got a good friend, several good friends on faculty down there, and I said, how do you like it down here? I went to Stillwater, you know, where Garth Brooks was and Ragweed and a lot of those great bands, and it was fun atmosphere and stuff. He said, yeah, it's a great atmosphere. He said, my neighbors had a block party, and they invited us to it, and they said it was going to be an ATF party. And I said, what's that stand for? He says, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. And he said, it was very true to their word that that's what was involved. So the Okie tradition. And then in Texas, you don't need $40,000 pickups and trailers to get your cattle to market. So Carla, I think, talked about some of the concepts of our systems research that Nebraska is known so well for. But looking at management decisions that would help a producer's bottom line, but not stopping there, looking further at how that impacts not only that immediate response, which might be reproduction of the cow that we're supplementing, but also how does it impact those animals that aren't even born yet. And if we're going to go after the high ticket items, we talked about we all know how high feed prices were last year. That's the biggest cost, no matter what phase of beef production we're talking about. And if we can decrease this harvested feed, likely we can improve profitability. And fortunately, Nebraska doesn't stay covered in snow for very long, or traditionally doesn't, and we have a lot of winter grazing in Nebraska. But when we winter graze, we're at a time when nutrient quality of the forage drops down below some 6% protein. And at a time when we have all this fetal growth occurring, what are the implications? Well, this first study looked at two management practices to potentially help producers be more profitable. One was weaning time, and one was the need for supplementation. So those are the four treatment combination, weaning in August or November and then supplementing or not. Here's the body condition curves. Those cows that were weaned early in August, better condition going into calving in April. And then, of course, breeding wasn't until June. They fell below what we might recommend body condition at calving, which had the higher preg rates. They were very similar. And if we look at the curves for supplementation, we see similar separation at calving, that those cows that were not supplemented, nothing all winter. I mean, they got probably white salt. No protein supplement all winter. They were below what we would probably recommend body condition at calving. But look at going into breeding in the spring calving herd, no difference in preg rate. So the reason that we're weaning early or supplementing, the benefit of that cow, we just haven't seen it. And these cows are from these studies. They're a composite Red Angus Simmental. We use composite cows and composite bulls to simplify the crossbreeding program. About a 1,200-pound cow when she weans a calf in November. And, of course, this was one of the first indications. This just shows the difference in weaning weight on those early weaned or later weaned calves. But if you look at this early weaning time, those calves that were from supplemented mothers, their weaning weights were greater, which made us think maybe we're not just impacting that reproductive event, which we weren't, but what about the progeny that weren't even born yet? And if you take those calves clear to slaughter, if you look at the treatment of weaning in November without supplement, we lost nearly 100 pounds of live weight by something that happened before that calf was ever born. And we do economics on all these studies, and the most profitable system was to wean in November and supplement if you took those calves clear to harvest because of that 100 pounds of additional live weight. It was 60 pounds of carcass weight. The next study looked at supplementation again during winter or not, and then a post calving treatment, which largely had no effect, so I won't talk about that. This was a three-year study, running age cows. Again, it was a pound of a 42% crude protein cake. And we actually sent the heifers before we got our feed efficiency facility in Nebraska to North Dakota. They got to spend the winter in North Dakota. How lucky for these heifers. Well, they were inside, so they weren't so unhappy. But I do a lot of work in heifer development, and I think the adoption has been taken up in not only Nebraska but other parts of the country. But these are some lighter developed heifers. And I think part of the reason we don't do this is because maybe we're not that proud of them. Maybe we don't want our neighbors to see them, but what do they look like when we preg check? Those are the same exact heifers, and they grow into themselves. There's a huge amount of compensatory gain. But again, we saw no benefit of supplementation for that cow breeding back. We did see more live calves weaned if that calf was from a supplemented cow. And in this study, these calves were weaned in October, and I think that's partly why we saw a little difference in slaughter weights because of the earlier weaning, better condition of the cow, even though she wasn't supplemented. The heifer data, we look at the effect of weaning weight, adjusted 205-day weight, and preg check weight. They were all less if that heifer came from a cow that wasn't supplemented. If we look at age at puberty and percent cycling, two things we think are real important for reproduction to occur, no effect. But if you looked at the percent of heifers calving in the first 21 days and final preg rate was decreased in those heifers that came from cows that weren't supplemented. So not only have we impacted live weight of the steers by how we manage the cow, now we've impacted fertility of the daughters. And this next study looked at another feed source that we have a lot in Nebraska. But we don't use near what we have. Less than, I think the numbers, Carla, if she's here, less than 10% of the available corn acres are actually grazed in Nebraska. If we're going to grow our cow herd, it's not going to be with grass, not with those high feed costs. It's going to be with management systems that allow us to utilize more of this. So we wanted to see, do we need to supplement on winter range or corn residue for the benefit of the cow, but now also the benefit of the calf also. So again, this was a three-year study, and this supplement was a pound of a 32% cube that was primarily distillers. So winter range, corn residue, protein supplement, no supplement. Some of the pictures of the cows grazing, snow's not a big problem, ice is. On corn stalks, but they'll dig through snow very well. We finished the steers at North Platte. We also did feed efficiency measures, and this is all in your proceedings, but the supplement contained Monensin, trace mineral package, and mostly distiller's grains. So which will cows do better on, winter range or corn residue? Some of you know the answer if you do it. So it was interesting. There's not a lot of data out there. Those two top lines, That's the point farthest to your left is when they came home from stocks. The two top lines are the two treatments on corn residue. We saw no benefit of supplementing those cows on even weight change. If you look at the middle lighter blue line, we did see a weight response in supplementing the cows that were on winter range, just like we saw in the previous two studies. But if we look at preg rate, no difference. No difference in supplementing of any of those treatments. On why we think we're supplementing that cow. Look at the bottom line on this graph, the second in, no supplement winter range. The percent calving in the first 21 days, we had less. They were getting pregnant, but they were getting pregnant later. Those cows from the most nutritionally challenged treatment, which was the no supplement winter range. If we look at steer feedlot performance, we lost nearly 70 pounds of live weight on that calf if that cow wasn't supplemented on winter range, but not on corn residue. You know, that's not too bad out of a 1,200-pound cow finishing a 1,350-pound calf fed that'll grade in the upper 90% choice with very few fours. And if we look at quality grade in this study, the percent choice in the first column, we decreased marbling before those calves were ever born. by how we treated the cow. And then the second column is the upper two-thirds choice. In both systems, if we didn't supplement the cow, we decreased marbling of those calves. And then the overall effect of protein supplement on a percent choice. So something that happened before that calf was even born affected how well they graded at slaughter. So I think these cattle are all the same genetics. These cattle are all the same genetics randomly. And we're affecting things that we as an industry are selecting for through assisted DNA technology, for example. But I think it brings home the point, it's not going to work unless management's there. If we look at the heifers, percent puberal before breeding and age at puberty actually was compromised in those heifers born to cows that weren't supplemented. And overall preg rate was decreased in both systems if they came from a cow that wasn't supplemented. Now there's others doing research and trying to look at more mechanisms of what's going on with fertility, with heifer reproduction. Bob Cushman's doing some work at U.S. Meat Animal Research Center on antral follicle count. And there's data, and I know you can't see this, but there's data that shows that cows that are carrying fetuses and being restricted, they have lower antral follicle count. And he has a paper that's currently in press with these four different nutritional planes during gestation, and actually didn't find a difference in antral follicle count, but found a difference in the percent calves born in the first 21 days, just like we did, okay? And then when he characterized those calves by when they were born, the calves born in the first cycle had greater antral follicle count. So there's interesting. There's a lot of things going on. We don't understand all the mechanisms, all the things, but we know that somewhat severe restriction, where these cows are somewhere below a condition score 5, is 10, 12 years worth of data has the potential to impact those calves that aren't even born yet. What about feed efficiency? Which are more efficient, the calves from supplemented or non-supplemented cows? It's actually the calves from non-supplemented cows are more efficient. And then a lot of people think that's counterintuitive to what we've just been talking about. But that calf being developed in an environment that's restricted, that nutrients are limiting, is being programmed to itself be more efficient once it's born. There's a condition, and Amanda may cover it, in humans called thrifty fetus, that we see a similar condition in mothers that are both obese or malnourished during gestation, that their children have metabolic problems, obesity, diabetes later in life. And so this is just the data on feed efficiency. We've installed a GrowSafe system, so we're measuring feed efficiency in all these steers on these studies now, so hopefully we'll get some more data. And we have two studies that we're just in the process of publishing on that I don't have a lot of data on. I'm going to just cover very briefly. But on grazing corn residue, cows do better. And has no benefit to supplementing those cows other than marbling in the calves, which is interesting. And protein supplement on winter range, we increased body weight of the cows. We had earlier calving date, more calved in the first 21 days. And the weaning weight and slaughter weights were heavier if they were supplemented on winter range. The other thing we saw, and I didn't mention it, but we saw less post-weaning sickness in the calves that came from cows that were supplemented. We didn't see any difference in sickness from birth to weaning, but we did from weaning to slaughter if those cows came from, or the calves came from cows that weren't supplemented. Amanda was involved in this study, did all the meat science work on this. We actually had three treatments. Cows and Kalen Gates, and TL feeds all these cows, so she gets credit too, but feeds either a high roughage diet with no supplement, a supplement high in bypass protein, or a supplement that's high in degradable protein. And what we saw was these cows that had given birth to calves that were supplemented had heavier placement weights, but we're seeing some interesting differences in composition at slaughter. Those calves from cows that are not supplemented had greater back fat, more marbling, and lower shear force. So they were, and Amanda's going to cover more on the meat side, but this data is not published yet, but I think it's very interesting. These cattle were not restricted. They were first calf heifers. They were all gaining weight. Andy Roberts up at Miles City, there's some guys from Miles City here, has done some similar work. Cows that were either controller restricted and then our daughters controller restricted, he saw greater retention rate in calves from cows that came from the restricted treatment. And he also saw lower birth weight in those restricted, as well as lower weaning weight. So his thought is, or theory, that these restricted heifers that then have calves that are restricted, their efficiency is greater. They may require less feed per pregnant heifer, and it potentially impacts longevity. And it may be a mechanism by which these animals over time are adapting to a low nutrient environment by decreasing output, by decreasing birth weight and weaning weight, which is probably through milk. So again, these are some composite cows at Fort Keogh. So the consequences of nutrient restriction need to be considered not only for the animal that we think we're impacting, but also what's going on here with the fetus. And as fetal programming, and Amanda's going to cover more of these concepts, but the stimuli experienced during fetal growth or fetal development impacting postnatal growth and physiology. We've known about it in humans for a long time. This mother worries about the jackhammer noise down the street impacting her unborn child, not to mention whatever brand of cigarette she has in her hand. But I need to get royalties, because every time I mention this book, I know somebody says, well, I ordered this online to my Kindle, whatever that is, I don't know. But so this is how the 9 months before birth shaped the rest of our lives. This woman is a medical journalist, and she's documenting conditions of women going through pregnancy, like overnutrition, undernutrition, and she's pregnant herself, so it's an interesting perspective. But not only those severe insults or events, chronic events, but some events that are more short-lived, like women that were pregnant during 9/11, that their children born later are now having developmental problems, that the children that were born 9 months after 9/11 had a skewed sex ratio in which there were more girl babies born, where she has documented a tribe, an Aboriginal tribe in Canada that lives in an area where there's several industrial plants, that they don't have enough children or boys for basketball teams, that there's a skewed sex ratio in these populations that experience some traumatic event or live in an environment that's somehow deemed as traumatic, and the thought is it's a way of perpetuation of that species. It's more advantageous to have girl babies born than males. And several other cases like the hurricane victims, the tornado victims as well. So if we take it a step back and we focus a lot on the female side and impacts of fetal programming on the fetus during gestation, but this study was done in mice, albeit, where they made these male mice, either obese or normal, whatever a normal mouse is, they mated them to a random population of mice and found that the pups from the obese males had problems during development with metabolic problems during development as measured in these mice with by hormone profiles. So things that are happening even before conception occurs that's being transmitted from the DNA of the male is impacting the progeny. That's pretty amazing. And there's a lot of people looking at the molecular mechanisms in that area. There's a lot of people interested in it in sports as well. And bodes the question, when did Michael Phelps become a good swimmer? So all that training may have not did him all that much good, right? So with that, I know Chip Ramsey's here and several people from the Rex Ranch. I want to give credit for John Young took these pictures and in this talk with from the heart of cattle country and the heart of the sand hills. Thank you for your attention. So.